history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And what a story we have in store for you today. You're going to hear about a device you've probably used thousands of times in your life that you don't know the origin of, and you're going to learn that today. You're going to hear from a man who really improved on it and spread it around the country. You're also going to learn about the Battle of Midway and how the intelligence came to being, how America found out what was happening on the Japanese side of things. And there are many, many other details. If you're a fly fisherman, maybe you'd like to hear some of the latest exploits of 104-year-old Jack Perrin, who joins us from Santa Barbara, California. That was not a misstatement. He really is 104 years old. So, Jack, I think we've got to start there, because I'm sure most people have never talked to someone who's 104. I usually save this for the end, but I'm going to go right up front. What's your secret? How have you made it to 104 years old and still be as sharp as you are today?
Well, I have a joke. I always tell everybody it's tequila. But it's not really.
I mean, there must be something that you have done or practiced or maintained to still be going so strong at that incredible age.
Well, I don't know. My mother was up in her middle 90s, and my real father was up there pretty much in the 90s, but he was divorced. I had was raised by a stepfather, but the real father was a Dane. He and my mother divorced.
And I was reading about that in your book, On a Roll, the story of entrepreneur Jack Perrin and Towel Saver Incorporated. Some people might recognize that Towel Saver name. Even if they don't, they've used a Towel Saver before. And I understand that this idea of a paper towel dispenser was actually born at a USC-UCLA football game when you went with Jay Perrin, your adoptive father?
That's absolutely correct. I was with him.
So what happened? Tell us the story.
Well, that was the old days when the big Coliseum was a small. It wasn't as big as it is now. My dad would go to the games a lot. He'd take me. And he was in the restroom one time. I was with him. And you know, those on the little square boxes where they have a folded towel, one fold. You pull one towel down that is divided in half. Sometimes now you pull one out, it comes like an accordion, but a lot of them are come by with just one fold. Well, they used to put a package on top of the dispenser, and like place special like the Coliseum. And, of course, they get spilled on the floor and it would be a big mess. But nevertheless, that was a problem.
So he noticed that, and he thought, hey, maybe there's a better way to do this?
He thought there was a better way to do it. He picked them up, and he theoretically met. His dad was an inventor, too, actually. This is my stepdad now.
Right.
Wonderful guy. Wonderful man. A great father. Well, somebody, of course, naturally pulls it down. The whole thing goes on the floor. And so he saw that, and he got thinking about it. And so that's when he invented the thing that he invented, a paper towel dispenser. He had a lot of patents on it, and it was very good.
And so this was the first ever paper towel dispenser. So you're a boy growing up around his whole process of demoing this, finding money to support the invention, actually producing it and distributing it. So you saw a lot of that process play out. I bet that was fascinating for you to witness as a boy.
Well, he had been in the oil business where he sold rope for hemp, oil companies, to the purchasing agents, but he knew them all. That's how he got his start, because he'd go around all the purchasing agents that he knew, and he used to give a big party for them once a year. So he had a very good cadre of friends. He was very well thought of, and a very nice guy, Jay Perrin.
And I want to come back around to your own role in growing Tal Saver and the things that you did with it after World War II. But before we get into the war, I'm just curious for you as a young boy, growing up in Southern California, was there something you had in your mind, some kind of hope or dream or ambition that someday this is what Jack Perrin's going
to
do?
I really never thought of that. I was very busy doing what I had to do. I worked on Saturday mornings when I was going to high school. I'd go down there working. We'd have these dispensers that we loaned out for no charge, and if they would buy our paper. I worked two jobs, really, because we didn't have much money in those days. We'd fix these dispensers. They'd have a crank on them, little square boxes. It was when they first came out. And you lift the lever and you turn a crank, and you get one towel. And the whole theory was that you'd have to do a little work to get a paper towel, and you wouldn't do in this old-fashioned way where you put a whole package on top and one falls on the floor. And that's what happened down at the Coliseum. And that was one thing that encouraged my father to develop the towel saver.
And you mentioned something there that I was struck by when reading your book here, On a Roll, where you said when he first developed this towel saver, he did one thing that was really crucial ultimately to the success of it. He didn't charge people for the dispensers. He let them use them for free.
Right.
But the paper had to be your paper because the dispenser wouldn't work with any other paper.
Absolutely.
Genius.
That carried on for a long time. The government didn't like it. They said it was not fair or something like that. I don't know.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Fairfax High School.
And you were a pretty good athlete, I understand?
I wasn't real good, no, but I was satisfactory. I threw the shot put and discus, and the only one that beat me was Woodrow Strode, who was a very good athlete, but he developed some kind of a problem health-wise, and he couldn't do it anymore. So I took over as number two man on the UCLA team.
Yeah, so you're at UCLA. In the late 30s, you finally graduated in 1941. When I saw that, immediately, I thought of some of the other people who were there at that time. Woody Strode is one of them. He went on to quite a career in acting. People have seen him in Spartacus. I believe he also did some wrestling for a while and was a great football player on the UCLA team. And you played football there, too?
Oh, he was a good football player. Strode and Kenny Washington, and very nice people, nice men. And very well thought of. Kenny was a pretty good friend of mine. He's a very nice guy, Kenny was. And Strode, and they would pal around together, and they were always in classes with some of them. I put the shot in discus.
Wasn't that the same time that guy Jackie Robinson was there?
That's exactly right. He'd come by and say, "Move away, I'm Jackie Robinson."
What did you enjoy the most about your time at UCLA? What was the highlight for you?
Well, I was in the fraternity. Still have my ring where I was president of my fraternity out. We had two men that were children of, what's the guy's name, a movie actor with a big loud mouth.
Joey Brown?
Yeah, Joey Brown Sr. and his two sons were in our fraternity. And his dad, Big Mouth Joe, you know, he came and registered in one class for 1 year, one semester, so he could become a fraternity member too.
The father did?
Yeah.
Huh.
He was a nice very nice guy. I enjoy them all very much.
You know, one thing that I like to ask all the veterans I interview about, because it seems like everybody remembers something, whenever I throw out that date, December 7th, 1941, there always seems to be a memory. What do you remember about that day and how you found out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I do remember very well. When I was working for Aetna Life Insurance Company in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I graduated from UCLA. I got a job. My girlfriend picks up my diploma for me because I had to stay and work out of Pennsylvania. We arranged to get married, but then we decided not to. So we later on, when the war started and everything went differently, we stuck away and got married.
I'm always fascinated by the reasoning behind decisions like that because I've had a lot of veterans who say, well, I didn't want to get married in case I didn't come back. And I've had a lot of other veterans say, I wanted to get married even if I didn't come back. Was that something that crossed your mind that as you joined the Navy, regardless of the kind of work that you were going to be doing, that there was a chance you wouldn't come back to your wife?
It never entered my mind. We flew to Las Vegas to get married. And it was very funny because I didn't know how to salute or anything. And I got my commission in the Navy. I went down and bought my uniform and everything I was supposed to do. And in those days, if you went to college, you could become an officer right away. But it was my case. I didn't have to go to officer school or any of that stuff.
So you hadn't actually reported yet, but you had your uniform, and you got married in your uniform?
Yes, I did. I got off the plane. There was a guard there with a rifle, a bayonet, and everything, and he was saluting me. Hell, I didn't know how to salute, so I just said hi and didn't salute, which I feel embarrassed about ever since. But anyway, that's what was life in those days. We came back home and had 10 delightful days of a honeymoon, and I had saved up for a few $1,000s. And I said, saved it all. We spent it all in San Francisco, going to all the places and restaurants and places my father had gone to when he was in business. And they knew him, but a lot of them, so I had a pretty good deal. And a good friend of his let us use his apartment and car. And he put me in a hotel, both of us, my wife and I. I would get up every morning, pack my suitcase, and go down to the Navy Department. They say to bring your clothes. You may not come back. So every morning for about 10 days, I'd take my suitcase, go down the Naval Building. It's a great big structure in San Francisco. And I'm waiting for a ship to take me away to Hawaii. Took my suitcase every day, every time I do it for about the 10 days. And then one time I didn't come back. And so she knew that. So now I'm gone for 2.5 years. Kind of lonesome.
Well, you know, I wanted to hit on something before I talk about what you did in the Navy, because we're just getting into the Navy part of your story here. You know, 10 days in a row, as you said, you're going down to the Navy office with a suitcase, you're kissing your wife goodbye. The last time you don't come back to her, you don't see her for 2.5 years.
That's right.
But I want to hear what she was doing for those 2.5 years, because she was one of the women all over our country who found a way to contribute to this greater war effort. What was she doing?
She went to work for the big aircraft company, Douglas. She worked for Douglas and saved money, and I saved money, and I sent her the much as I could, but she's living with her mother.
So they send you to Hawaii. I read that you were on basically a banana boat that the Navy put into service.
A little banana boat, the USS Salamanca, and on the ship, they had me reading the code. Maybe we'd get messages from other people, and I would help them to decipher them and put them in English. Because of that, I think they put me in the Naval Intelligence. They shipped me to Hawaii, and we started off, three actually, ended up doing it, going around checking on people and bad guys and good guys in Hawaii. At this point, we went to work at the Halekulani Hotel, which was owned by a big Navy officer, but that didn't last very long. At 10 days of heaven, going to the floor shows and everything else in Hawaii. But after about a week, they called us in and said, well, you three guys are going down someplace else. Pack your bag and get in the station wagon. And we did and went down to the submarine base. And we were both, all three, went in to be inspected. And it was a secret passageway kind of in the basement. We went back down there and it was a kind of a dungeon place with a special guard and all that. And it turned out to be a very secret place. It was where they were reading the Japanese code. So it was obviously a very secretive place. And we sneak down there. We go down the basic tunnel, another drop down, and you go in the basement of another building that was there. There was a senior officer in charge. He had a couple other officers around, but there wasn't too many people. And there were about a half a dozen men breaking codes.
Let me bring you right back there in a minute, but I do have another question, because you're arriving there in Hawaii about 6 months after the Japanese arrived in that surprise attack.
We were there in April.
So I'm guessing that you could still see evidence of what had happened in December. What were some of the things you saw, and was it jarring to you? Could you see the Oklahoma, the Arizona?
Oh, yeah, you could see all that. I didn't go out in a boat and look at them, but I could see the something sticking up, and I knew, I was aware, of course, that they've been sunk with a lot of men. And then I had another one, but most of the men got off, and they were the band of one of the battleships, and the band got off.
I'm just curious, because here you are, if I do the math, you're 25 years old. This war has started, and now you're at the place where it began, and you're seeing something that I imagine might be a little sobering when you see a battleship upside down or sunk and you know how many lives were lost. Can you help us understand what kind of emotions maybe that produced in you?
I can't recognize that I had emotions. I think maybe I've been getting used to things that didn't bother me.
And you mentioned the band. So you're talking about the USS Maryland, which is another battleship that was damaged at Pearl Harbor. And some of the bandsmen actually ended up working in that code room with you?
Absolutely. They worked with the translators. There were about five translators, about three of them working all the time, reading the Japanese code. There's a certain technique in reading codes and breaking them down, and they were very good at it. And they absorbed both of the music guys that had been on the battleship Maryland, and so most of the band went with our unit, but it was divorced from our unit, but it was part of our unit, you know what I mean?
And this was Hypo?
Yeah. Well, Roanford was the commanding officer of the unit, and he was a Mustang, which means he did not go to the academy. The regular Navy people in Washington criticized him, but they wanted to have the glory of some of the success we had.
Well, and I want to talk about some of that success you had, but first maybe you can just help us understand. So this is in the basement of the administration building at Pearl Harbor.
In the basement.
And this is secret work that you guys are doing. So how far did you carry that secrecy? Were you allowed to tell any of your friends that this is what you were doing, or tell your wife that this is what you were doing?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Very, very secretive.
Uh-huh.
This is breaking the Japanese code. We broke their code, and they didn't know we had done it. We could read the Japanese stuff, and they couldn't read ours, theoretically. I think they probably did read some of ours anyway.
I'm curious about the secrecy element. I'm sure you and your wife are writing letters back and forth. What did she think you were doing out there?
Well, every letter she got had things cut out. She didn't know anything about doing.
The censors took some scissors to it?
All my mail was censored, and it was cut out or erased or something.
You know, so many of the vets that I've interviewed were in a plane, you know, flying against the enemy, on a ship in battle with the enemy, in a foxhole watching artillery come in. Here you are in a basement at Pearl Harbor. Did you have a sense of the gravity or importance of your work, and that maybe even lives depended on whether or not you did your work well?
Oh, we understood about the work pretty well, because, I mean, it was so secret and it was so important, because we were reading the code. Let's say it says a 15-20 ship convoy of Japanese coming from down south somewhere, and they're coming up to hugging the coast for safety, and they're coming right back up to Tokyo. We'd get some of those kind of things. So we could sit our submarines out, and maybe that'd be my watch. Let's say it's midnight, and I'm the only one on watch. If a message comes through, I'd have to send the message out to our submarine.
So when you say a message comes in, is that a message coming in plain English, or is that encoded?
Well, it could be encoded. Let's see, a message comes in Kana alphabet. And the Kana alphabet is, of course, the Japanese alphabet. Mm-hmm. But then we've broken the code so we can read it. Some of them. We have four or five translators that are working on that. And these translators are people, including our commanding officer in my unit. They lived in Japan to learn the customs and to do it. I was very impressed by that. The fact that they had arranged ahead of time to watch out for it.
That there were people that had been living in Japan before the war who then could put that knowledge to use.
The Navy places men in key positions where they can learn things that will help them at the time of war. That's what came through to me, and it was very good. These were men like Mike Skipper, Roquefort. He was able to communicate in Japanese because he studied Japanese over there. So anyway, Roquefort was very, very capable man.
And we'll hear more about Joseph Roquefort and the secret work that he and Jack Perrin and others carried out at Station Hypo when we come back. The Battle of Midway was the pivotal moment of the Pacific War, but perhaps the most important break in that battle came in that basement dungeon, as Jack called it, at Pearl Harbor. We'll learn more about it from this 104-year-old Navy veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that it's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 104-year-old Jack Perrin of Santa Barbara, California. Because of COVID-19 restrictions, he can't have any in-person visitors, not even family, which I'm sure you can imagine is quite difficult. And you know, there are so many seniors who are dealing with similar situations, so you probably know some of them. Maybe you ought to give them a call today. It means a lot more than you think, especially in times like these. I want to thank Adrian at Casa Dorinda in Santa Barbara for facilitating this phone interview with Jack, who played football and competed in shot put and discus at UCLA before the war. His teammates included Jackie Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier after serving in World War II, as well as Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, who right after the war became two of the first four African-American players in the National Football League. Jack would go on to great success as the leader of Towel Saver Incorporated. You can read about that in his book, On a Roll, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We're going to try to get to that in a bit, but I also want you to get a good picture of the secret but crucial work he was doing in Navy intelligence during World War II. If you've seen the movie Midway, which came out in 2019, you might remember that a key moment comes when Admiral Chester Nimitz, played by Woody Harrelson, has to decide whether to go with the advice from Naval Intelligence in Washington, D.C., or with the belief of the code breakers in that secret basement office at Pearl Harbor, the station Hypo, where Jack Perrin was serving under Lieutenant Commander Joseph Roquefort. The Roquefort character in that latest Midway film is quite memorable. You definitely get the picture of his uniqueness and how tirelessly the men of Hypo, or FRUPAC, Fleet Radio Unit Pacific, its other name, were working to glean as much information from intercepted Japanese Navy transmissions as possible. At times, they even worked 36-hour shifts. But in the film, Jack, and in reality, Nimitz has to choose between what Roquefort says and what the men in Washington, D.C. say. That would prove critical, and it really seems like there was some pretty strong tension.
They were in Washington doing the same thing we're doing in Hawaii, but not nearly as well, and not as thorough. We were getting, we're down there right in the heart of it. But nevertheless, Roquefort himself was a very, very good man. He knew all of that. I told you, he lived there, knew the language, knew the people, knew the customs, and he was a wonderful skipper, believe me.
So I know one of your passions has been fishing, and you even established a fly fishing academy at Silver Lake, one of your favorite spots in the Eastern Sierra. But
yeah.
As I understand it from way back in 1942, you guys threw out a little bait for the Japanese. Whose idea was it to send a plain language message and see if you could get the Japanese to confirm the location of their planned attack?
That was actually, I heard them let you go. Jasper Holmes was the executive officer for our officer in charge, which was Roquefort.
And so they said that they could fake some kind of problem on Midway? The message said something about the water desalination plant failing or something?
Yeah. Roquefort sent a plain language communication that the water was Midway was no good anymore or something. The thing broke down that supplied the water.
So, I mean, this was a real creative plan to kind of sucker the Japanese into confirming that Midway was indeed the target, because otherwise the brass was going to focus the attention on one of those other spots, right?
Well, they wanted the brass wanted to go down south. Well, that was foolhardy.
And so somewhere in the codes that you had intercepted, the Japanese had been talking about a target that they referred to as AF.
AF.
So then once you kind of put out the bait about Midway having a water plant problem, then you intercept the Japanese broadcasting about AF?
Yeah, well, yeah, that, they just talk about a water problem, but it didn't have it. They just talked about it.
Yeah, but I understand that even after that, so basically the Japanese have confirmed in your minds there at Hypo that Midway is the target, but Roquefort still had a hard time convincing Washington that that was the case.
Well, I don't think he had too hard a time because he would feed it to Nimitz, and Nimitz would carry the ball.
So first the question is, well, where is this battle going to take place? Where are the Japanese going to concentrate their forces? And then you guys are still there at Pearl Harbor as the Battle of Midway unfolds, which we know now is a huge turning point in the war. What was it like for you as you found out, you know, you kind of got a play-by-play, as it were, about what was happening at Midway?
Everything we did, I thought we were on the upper hand.
Was there any kind of reaction, celebration among your fellow Hypo personnel when you all got word of what really turned into a great American victory at Midway?
Well, everybody's very happy, but in wartime, you don't get very happy about it, anything, really. It's part of the job, and you get it done, and you're pleased about it.
You know, there's so many facets to a giant battle like Midway, and we've heard from a lot of people over the years on this program who were there, whether they're on one of the carriers or, you know, they're in a dive bomber diving on these Japanese carriers.
Yeah.
One of the other stories that has become very famous is the story of Torpedo Squadron 8 and the fact that only one of the pilots from that squadron survived, Ensign George Gay. And I think I heard that you were actually at your station when a message came in that they had recovered Ensign Gay.
Yeah, they found him. He was floating around the ocean.
So we move on from Midway, and just a few months later, a couple months later, you have the Battle of Guadalcanal. And I wanted to ask you about this. You said a very good friend of yours was killed aboard the USS San Francisco.
That was Witter, Gene Witter.
How did you know him?
Well, he's a fraternity brother. He's a fraternity's eight. I'm his eight. And his fraternity is in Cal, and mine's in UCLA. But we got to know each other, and he was there on the USS San Francisco. It all beat up the Guadalcanal. He was a very nice guy.
Well, let's talk about Admiral Yamamoto.
Oh, yeah.
You've given a few talks about your war experience, and I'm sure people have asked you, who was Admiral Yamamoto, and what did you guys have to do with him?
Yamamoto was the head of the whole Japanese Navy. He spent a lot of time in the United States. He got shot down because we broke the code that he was coming on the inspection tour. This is after Guadalcanal. He was a...
Well, maybe we approach it this way. So you're the code-breaking work that you're doing continues long after Midway. And Midway, you trick the Japanese into giving away the location of their attack. So instead of them surprising the Americans kind of surprise the Japanese. But you're continuing to work on this Japanese code to decipher it, and it gets to the point where you guys have a pretty good handle on it, and you're able to intercept a message that's saying exactly where Yamamoto is going to be. And you actually have that message, right?
Correct. We had the message. We knew he was going to be flying, making a survey of the different stops where they had outposts. They broke that down, the fact where it was and so forth, and that made it very easy for us. Not easy, but advantageous.
I'm going to try to read this here because I have a picture of it because you've held on to this. It says, on 18 April, Combined Fleet will visit in accordance the following schedule. And it says, you know, depart at 0600 in a medium attack plane escorted by six fighters. And it goes on and on. And I'll put a picture of this online at hometownheroesradio.com. But you guys have a clear, perfect picture of where the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack is going to be flying.
Correct.
How did you guys obtain that? How did you figure that out?
Because he put out his itinerary. He was going to make a stop at different spots where they have outposts. He would stop and say hello and go on the next one, inspection tour. So he was vulnerable to something being read.
So because your office was able to intercept that message, you pass it along. And ultimately, the Army Air Corps sends 16 P-38s up after him and took care of business, huh?
Correct.
Yeah, so as I understand it, this is something that Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Halsey discussed, whether they should go ahead and take Yamamoto out, and they decided to do it. So then those P-38s go after him, and there's actually a pilot by the name of Rex Barber who shot him down. I guess what I'm curious for you is, as someone who is there at Hypo, working in the basement all this time while the war is going on all over the world, getting the news of that, was there some significance to that when you find out, hey, they were able to take out Yamamoto because of what we learned?
It would feed the intelligence of them. I was down in the dungeon. Down in the basement of the building.
Did that work ever get monotonous when you're looking at numbers and letters and blocks of letters day and night?
No, because each one was different. It was exciting, really. It was exciting, and you knew you were doing something very constructive, and you were defending your commanding officer because you thought he was doing such a great job. Breaking the code, so helpful to them. The Japs had no idea we were breaking their code. They thought it was so confusing to us that they don't worry about it. That was the impression I got.
And, you know, we hit on a couple of the big ones. The fact that, you know, the tide was turned at Midway because of work that had been done in that dungeon there, and that Yamamoto was shot down. And in that case, you're the one who actually sent the message yourself, right?
Yeah.
So
whoever's on watch would send it.
So you had the privilege of taking that information and sending it out to the people that eventually would go after Yamamoto's plane and shoot it down.
Well, they were directed to it because of the intelligence that they used.
But on top of that, and Midway, there are a lot of other, you know, less famous situations where you guys would get messages about a Japanese convoy, and then the submarines could go and attack those convoys?
What happens would be certain hours at night that the submarines would come surface, and we'd wait for them. When they did it, we would broadcast to them and tell them what's happening, and the convoy is coming up from Malaysia or whoever it is, hugging the shore, a convoy of how many ships. And then our submarines could go and sit and wait for them. We had a field day with the submarines. Really great.
Did you ever get to go aboard a submarine?
Yeah, I went aboard of one and went through it. I didn't go on a mission. I just went was in dock. I went in. I wanted to see what it's like. And I remember mainly was just that ice cream machine. You could have ice cream whenever you wanted it.
That was enough to put up with that diesel smell that would stick with you when you left, huh? And another thing I noted in your book, as you said, because you were there at Pearl Harbor, where just about anybody in the Navy who's heading out to the Pacific, they're going to stop at Pearl Harbor. So you actually got to see a fair amount of your friends just on their way through?
Yes, I did. So a lot of them. We had naval housing. I had a house with two bedrooms and another officer and myself. And when my fellows came, I put them up in the room. We'd have a pretty good time.
Well, and when I asked you about Lorraine, when you're there on your honeymoon in San Francisco and then finally you have to leave, and, you know, you said you didn't see her for 2.5 years. So after 2.5 years, the Navy said you don't have to hang out in paradise anymore. You can come back to the mainland?
No, it wasn't that way. I talked to my commanding officer, Bertolet, Commander Bertolet, who I got to know pretty well. I said, gee, look, I've been over here 2.5, 3 years. I'd like to get home. So he arranged it for the fellow that was in Washington to take my job, and I was to take his job, which I thought was real nice. I didn't give a damn long as I got home.
What was that like to get home and see your wife again?
It was a heaven. I had my whites, traveled with my white uniform, a battle ribbon, all that stuff.
But the war wasn't over yet, so you still had work to do there in Washington, D.C. Was it the same kind of work you'd been doing in Hawaii, or was it different?
Let's put it this way. In Hawaii, I was a head cheese. When I got to Washington, I was a low man on the totem pole.
So what kinds of things did they have you doing?
Filing notes. To see what they would do, we'd have these messages. We had a great big desk with an index file of IBM cards. I'd mark out two places on or one place. We didn't try to overdo it, but we'd find a couple of places to file that message. So we would have the yeoman who worked with us make copies and file them. So when we wanted to compare it to some other message, they may have some word in there or some clue of what the next one's doing. When the next one comes up, we look at it, and well, let's see, it mentions this thing. Let's see if we have anything in the files about that. And we put two and two together to get four, and we did a lot of that. We had a great cadre of interpreters. Oh, boy, we had some great, great guys that were in the code breaking. They may be in a little different section than we are, but they're right next to us. They'd bring it into us, and our position would be to sign where it went. I got a message that looks like they're planning to do some convoy coming up to be on my watch. Our submarines are down there. At midnight, they surface, and then we tell them where to go. And then they go out there, and they wait for the ships to come around, the ones we want to attack. We wait for them to come because we know their schedule. We just wait for them to come, and there are submarines right there to get them. So we had a lot of luck by breaking their code, and they had not too much breaking ours. I remember VJ and I.
Yeah, let's hear about it.
The big crowd on the streets near the White House. It was exciting.
What did that feel like to know this is finally over? Everything I've been working on for 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in heaven.
The Navy wanted to keep you around for a while, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Offered me lieutenant commander, but I didn't want to do that. Wanted to get out of the Navy. One of my cohorts had the same job, ended up as an admiral.
So maybe that could have been Jack Perrin's future had he remained in the Navy after World War II. Instead, he launched a very fruitful and impactful career in the private sector. We've all heard that expression about how many lives we may have the opportunity to touch. There are plenty of those examples for Jack, and you're going to hear from a couple of them. But there's no way to measure how many wet hands he indirectly helped to dry, probably yours a time or two, through the towel saver dispensers that ended up all over America. And we wouldn't be talking to Jack if he had not survived a very scary situation on his favorite lake 7 years ago. Hear that remarkable story as well when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating visit today with 104-year-old Jack Perrin of Santa Barbara, California. It's impossible to squeeze 104 years of life into an hour on the radio. What doesn't fit here we'll include in the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. We've heard about his time as a UCLA student athlete, the secret naval intelligence work he did that, among other things, enabled the U.S. to set a trap for the Japanese at Midway and turn the tide in the Pacific War. But when World War II finally came to an end, Jack was ready to return home to California and go back to the paper towel dispenser business his stepfather had started after seeing a pile of wasted towels on the floor of an L.A. Coliseum men's room 15 years earlier. So, Jack, you went back to Towel Saver Incorporated, and it wasn't long until you were taking over the leadership role of that company from your dad.
Unfortunately, he was an alcoholic. That's the main problem. And he wasn't in very good health. So I kind of took over the business. And he finally died. And I really took it over. And I said, well, even when he was alive, I said, well, Dad, I've got to get this business going better. I wanted to go back east, open up the eastern market, which I did, east of the Mississippi River. See, we had the three coast states we sold directly to distributors, which was Crown Zellerbach Company. And they sold that to the Midwest, to the Mississippi. And they had another company competing with us on the other side of the Mississippi River. We let them sell it and pay us a royalty because we couldn't afford to travel around and do all that. So we did. We did pretty well.
And just kind of following along that story a little bit, one little detail that jumped out at me that I think a lot of people forget about, because we talk about World War II and the 16 million Americans in uniform and all the folks back home doing their part, but just simple things like during World War II, those dispensers were made out of wood instead of metal. Is that right?
We had it was just a plain simple wood thing with a holder and all. It wasn't a real dispenser.
But the metal was needed for the war effort, so they weren't producing the metal dispensers during that time.
That's right. You couldn't do it.
But then you come back, and you're actually looking at a design from before the war that had never been completed, and you kind of made that your own, your baby? Was that the C-5, I think it said?
Yeah, that was my. Well, they were going to throw those tools away.
The tools to make them in the factory?
Yeah. You have to get the tools to make the metal parts. Pretty big operation for a small company. But I made the dispensers.
So that became a new model of the towel saver.
Yes, I got one that then I used to have the lift the lever and turn the crank. And I changed it around to where you didn't do that. You just start to jiggle it and it freeze it and it'll turn. So you could turn it by just a hair breadth away from pulling back towards you. Well, the C5 they were going to throw away. They made a dispenser. It was smaller and compact, but it had no lock on the front. Couldn't lock it. They were going to throw it away. I wouldn't let them do it. I'm South sales manager now down there. And I thought we could use it. Sure enough, the big awkward-looking dispenser we had before was outdated by this new one. So the new one went, and it worked fine. Of course, it had no lock on it. We didn't care. We made a sales pitch out of it. It didn't have a new lock because the janitor had to get there in a hurry. Just use that as an asset rather than a liability. But anyway, I did a good job, and I sold a hell of a lot of them.
And before long, you could find those C5s in a lot of different places. And I bet you've probably even been a few places in recent years where you've stumbled across one or two and it puts a smile on your face. Do you have any stories like that where somewhere you've been and you realize, hey, they're still using one of my dispensers?
I'll tell you about one that surprises me. The big lake, Lake Crawley. You know where Lake Crawley is?
I don't think I do. Why don't you explain it for us?
Well, it's a great big lake right near Bishop.
Okay, yeah, on the eastern side of the Sierra. So you stumbled across a C5 up there?
He had a dispenser. They have our early model with the lever, lift the lever and turn the crank, still in use. And the reason is that the state of California bought our towels, and we have provided all these cabinets to them. California had our cabinets all over. Towel saver.
Talking about Crawley Lake and running into one of your early dispensers up there and the smile that put on your face.
It's still there, I think.
Still there in 2020. Well, there's another thing that's still there, although COVID-19 has put a crimp in it for now. But you are the man behind a fly fishing academy, a free fly fishing academy for kids at Silver Lake every year. Where did that come from? Why was that important for you?
Well, I wanted to teach the kids how to fly fish.
You were in your late 90s when you started this. Most people in their late 90s aren't starting anything. They're wondering if they're going to be able to finish something. It's just inspiring, I think, to hear about someone who has the vision to begin something like that, to pour into the lives of people much, much younger that's going to reap dividends for a long, long time. I imagine it's been fun for you to be around those young people.
Well, there's a man at the end of my lake. The mountains. I have a mountain cabin. He loves to work with young kids, but he runs the shop there. He owns it. He's a real nice guy, and I'm very close friends with him. But I started this program with the young kids, getting them involved and teaching them how to fly fish and all that. Once a year, the fellow that runs the camp there sets it up. We do a great job. We take all the young kids around 15, 16 years old. I like to get them around at age 14 to 15, better. And we teach them how to fly fish. We have a couple of instructors. A lot of people come and watch and help and they help. We bring 18, I think, in. We have the guides. And the guides take them out fishing. And we supply the shoes, wading pants, and a helmet, and glasses. Glasses for sure. We won't fish with them without glasses. Because it might get them in their eye. I know people get flies in their eye once in a while. So we watch it pretty carefully. It's my baby. I started it, and I just love it.
104 years is a long time to look back over, and there are a lot of things that you've been a part of, and we've heard just a few of them here today. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. When you reflect on 104 years, is there something that you are most proud of?
Oh, I would say that it's the thing I have for the kids. I'm the most proud of that, and it's very successful. Dad and parents are so happy, and they write me nice letters. I'm happy they are. Their kids will get that. So it's just a good deal. I'm very happy about it.
Well, you should be. What a gift that's going to be to a lot of people for a long time to come. And speaking of the future, I've never had a chance to ask a 104-year-old this question before, so I want to make sure I ask you. I know you've done a lot of things in your life. You've accomplished a lot. You've touched a lot of lives. But is there something you haven't done yet at 104 that you're still looking forward to, that you're still hoping to do?
Oh, that's a tough one. I have to think about that for a while. Well, my first love is to set up something for these young kids.
So it's impossible to miss Jack's affinity for Silver Lake and what a legacy he has there with all the young people learning fly fishing skills as a result of his thinking and his generosity. And we're actually going to be joined by someone who's very familiar with Silver Lake, has been out on that lake with Jack Perrin. That is Dr. Don Goffinette, who joins us now, Navy veteran of the Vietnam War, a longtime oncologist and faculty member at Stanford University. Don, Jack at Silver Lake, how far back do you two go with the time spent together out there fishing?
We bought our cabin in 1989 and met Jack almost from the day we got it, and we've been friends ever since. Our aquatic adventure took place, I believe, on a very cold day in the end of May 2013, 7 years ago.
So you're out on the lake with a 97-year-old World War II veteran.
Out in Jack's boat, and we'd been trolling. We caught a fair number of rainbow trout, and then we anchored about 50 yards offshore close to Jack's cabin, and then he wanted to start up and go in, but his motor wasn't working well. So I went from the bow to the stern and got the motor started and went back, and I just sat down at the bow when Jack, who is a big man, leaned over to pull up the anchor, and the next thing we knew, within a second, the boat was overturned, and we were in a cold, cold Silver Lake. And I didn't see Jack. It was very quiet, and a voice said, reach under the boat, which I did, and I felt some cloth, and I pulled hard, and up popped Jack. And we were able to stabilize him with one of the handholds on the stern of the boat, and then the motor shaft was sticking out, and he balanced on that. We were very fortunate that I had my red fleece fishing jacket on, and one of my arms was sticking out of the water, and Jack's wife, Kathy, saw the red jacket from her cabin. She notified two of our friends who came out with a boat and helped us get to shore. But it was quite an unexpected experience, and I'm very happy that we survived.
You know, I'm thinking about the number of gentlemen that I've had on this program telling their experiences from World War II when their ships would sink. We've had guys that, you know, were in the water for hours, if not days. We're right on top of the 75th anniversary of the USS Indianapolis sinking. A lot of those guys were in the water for 3-4 days.
Yeah.
And those guys were teenagers and in their 20s. Here you have a guy who's 97 and you in your 70s at the time. Were there some moments there where you guys didn't know if someone was going to find you?
Yeah, there was nobody on the lake, and the wind was blowing, was very cold. Jack wasn't going to be able to make it unassisted into shore, and I wasn't going to leave him, so I had just decided that we would either survive together or we would die there. And then fortunately, two of our friends, Roger Goetz and Jack Stark, came out, and Jack is a very big man, and so he could not get in the boat that came out, and he was pulled, towed to shore. I guess we were in the water about 20 minutes, but with a hot shower and a little rest, he was perfectly normal. So we were very, very fortunate that his wife saw my red jacket sleeve, which basically saved us.
Wow. Well, and what a courageous choice that you made to stay with Jack, and I know you're not asking for kudos for that. But I think we can all hear it, that was a decision you had to make and a risk you had to take. And I'm thinking about Jack being in the water and then, you know, clinging to the capsized hull. 97 years old. I mean, you're a doctor. You've treated patients in their 90s and those with conditions that, you know, were akin to being that old. How impressive was it to you that he could handle something like that and make it through that?
It was just amazing. He's a remarkable man and probably the best man that I've ever known. And we talked and we prayed, and Jack just got cold, but everything was functioning well. And by that time, Roger and Jack were towing us in, and Jack walked into his cabin and took a shower, and he was fine. We got a little hypothermia, but we weren't in the water that long, and we had heavy gear on. So we made it out, and We both did well.
And I don't want to be melodramatic. I'm just curious. How often do you think about that? Because I know you still frequent the lake. How often does that memory or that incident come back around in your mind?
Oh, it's frequent. There was a period of time when most people in this small place, Mono County, knew about it. And I would walk into the Silver Lake Resort, and the people at the counter would say, hi, Don, how's the water today? And they'd laugh, and a lot of people had fun at our expense for our aquatic expertise. But fortunately, it turned out well, and we have some unique memories of what we did.
And you haven't added aquatic adventures to the curriculum of the Fly Fishing Academy?
No. That was Jack's wonderful idea, and he engaged the man who is the son of the owner of the Silver Lake Resort, Andrew Jones, and Andrew put together the curriculum, the fly fishing teachers, the volunteers, and everything that went into it, and it was very, very well done. It's been a huge success, and that is thanks to Jack Perrin and his family.
Well, I hope we're hearing about those young people with that opportunity for a long time in the future, and I have to say thank you, Dr. Goffinette, for saving Jack's life, for risking your own to save his, and also for doing something else, because my conversation with him isn't the first time someone's recorded his World War II experiences. You actually did that, I guess, about a year ago. Why was that important to you to have some of that recorded, the stories that you had heard from him on the lake over the years?
Well, I knew that Jack is probably the last surviving member of the famous code-breaking team in Pearl Harbor. His boss was Joe Roquefort, who was one of the head spy masters in Pearl Harbor, and Jack made a major contribution to winning World War II, the Battle of Midway, and when Admiral Yamamoto was shot down in April of 1943. And I thought that ought to be preserved for posterity. I was actually quite young at the end of the war, but I do remember the war and the Doolittle Raid, and one thing stands out. There's a ghost town here called Bodie, which is the nicest, best-preserved ghost town in the country. A mining engineer and I were in Bodie on VJ Day, and that's almost 75 years ago now, and we were the only two there. I could go on, but the story got quite interesting, and when we were coming back to Silver Lake from Bodie, Stanley said, well, Don, the war's over. There's no more 35-mile-an-hour speed limit. Let's just go back to Silver Lake at 100 miles an hour, and we did.
Driving what?
I don't remember. I don't remember the car yet. I was only 8 at the time. But we went down in a mine shaft. I found a box of dynamite in Bodie, and I picked one of the sticks up, and it had a little substance on the end that looked like honey. I brought it to Stanley, and I said, Stanley, this dynamite has some liquid honey on it. And he looked at me, and he said, put that down. That's nitroglycerin. Let's get out of here. We were lucky we got out of Bodie on August 15th, 1945.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of those wounded Marines in Vietnam are thankful you made it out of there, and all your patients at Stanford over the years that you made it out of there. And I've heard a lot of VJ Day stories on this program, the parties in New York City or San Francisco or D.C. and the ships at sea and people all over the world. I didn't think I'd ever hear one about the ghost town of Bodie. No way.
Well, VJ Day in Bodie was unique, and I'm going to go back there on August 15th in less than a month and just tell them I was there for the first time 75 years ago.
That's beautiful. Well, maybe if Jack can get out of his current situation, maybe he can join you there. Is there anything else that you think we all ought to know about Jack? Because you had some very kind words about him. It's clear that you think very highly of him. What is the thing that you find most impressive or most valuable about his life and his example?
He's just a wonderful, wonderful, balanced man. And he's cordial. He's honest. He's straightforward. He's great to be with. I've never met a better man than Jack Perrin. He's just a wonderful man. And there's nobody like him. I've never met anybody like Jack Perrin.
Again, that was Dr. Don Goffinette. And there's one more voice I want you to hear. It's another doctor, Tim Perrin, Jack's son. What do you think we ought to know about your dad, Tim?
He's just a great guy. What's impressed me about my dad is just he doesn't focus on himself, and he really doesn't get flustered at problems. I guess it's going through World War II that contributed to that, but when problems come up, his response is, okay, well, what are we going to do to fix it? An example up at Silver Lake, my dad and my friend and I used to go up on opening day for about 20 years. And one day we got up there for opening day, and my friend looked in his cabin on the lake, and the whole thing was flooded. And my dad said, well, we can deal with that later. We need to go fishing, you know, and that's just the way he is. And so we did. So they called the company to come and up the cabin, and we just went off fishing. But my friend was devastated. I mean, he opened the door and looked at his cabin, and he just didn't know what to do. But my dad is amazing at 104. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and I've seen him go through quite a few medical procedures, and he's got a dozen specialists to take care of him. And he's just that way. He's just very matter-of-fact about it all. He has to go through major surgery or whatever he has to do. It's just, that's what you do. When he was up in his cabin 7 years ago and the boat capsized and the water was freezing and they almost died, he was very content to just pass on at that time, say his goodbyes and move on. And he's just, I think that's amazing this day when you've got so many people that are so upset about everything, protesting and writing about everything and all the things you're not happy with. I really believe that the mind of a man plans his way and the Lord directs his steps. I take rest in that. But I would say that probably what bothered my dad the most was the separation when he was over there for 2.5 years after just getting married. How did he do that? And I think that was a real lesson for me because my parents had such a strong relationship, and I think that contributed to it. The absence makes the heart go fonder. He's just a very strong leader, and he's not influenced by what other people think. I don't want to say it the wrong way. He gets a lot of advice from a lot of people, but he doesn't hesitate to listen to what everybody has to say and then do something totally different. He really thinks for himself, and I appreciate that. He's part of the greatest generation. I really believe that. When that movie, The Midway, came out last year, and we watched that, and I watched it with my dad, that was very powerful. It really made it real to me. You know, you hear these stories, and it sounds like, oh, long, long, long ago, and a time far away, whatever, you know. We lose track of history, and that's what I appreciate about having my dad around. He's 104, is being able to see history as relevant, that it really is relevant, and it really did happen. It wasn't just a story. It wasn't just a movie. We're going through our own problems right now, and I think being able to watch that movie gives a little perspective on our situation today.
Well, if you've spent the last hour with us, maybe your perspective is a little different from when we began. Thanks to Tim Perrin, Don Goffinette, and 104-year-old Jack Perrin. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.